I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they create and the poems that created them.
You know, you have sort of a feeling of love, of passion when you're working on a poem. You know, you go after it the way you might go after a lover. My name is Jericho Brown, and this is Duplex. The opposite of rape is understanding, a field of flowers called paintbrushes. A field of flowers called paintbrushes, though the spring be less than actual. Though the spring be less than actual, men roam shirtless as if none ever hurt me. Men roam that myth. In truth, one hurt me. I want to obliterate the flowered field, to obliterate my need for the field and raise a building above the grasses, a building of prayer against the grasses, my body a temple in disrepair. My body is a temple in disrepair. The opposite of rape is understanding.
Holy moly, your reading of that poem was incredible.
Thank you.
I've spent so much time with this book and these poems, and you know, you sort of get it in your own mind, mm-hmm. and you just like soars in your own voice.
Thank you.
It's just such a beautiful reading.
Thank you, Kate.
So let's just first talk about these four or so poems in the book called Duplex, mm-hmm. which I can perceive is a form, but is not a form that I'm familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you could tell me how you came to this form, how you made it, and just how do you come to something like that when you're working on a book?
The duplex marries three ancestor forms, I'll say. The blues, the sonnet, and the huzzle. And when I was first thinking of the form, I was thinking about creating some sort of a vessel that could contain several identities. And the reason why I was thinking about that is because that's the way I think about myself. I think about myself as a Black Southern queer poet. And then there are all these other identities even after that. Do you know what I mean? And I wanted a form that was as much a mutt as I feel that I am. And a form that was not necessarily narrative or not necessarily discursive. There's a way I feel in the world that I'm not necessarily a straightforward story in any way. And yet I do tell one. I am the evidence of some sort of very long history or very long story. And so I had been thinking a lot about sonic crowns and coronas, mm-hmm. and about how there's that repeated line that gets you from one sonnet to another.
Can you explain what a sonnet crown is, just really briefly?
Yeah, I mean, it's a series of sonnets. You know, some would say 10, some would say 7, some would say 14. But a series of sonnets that are linked in the last line of the first sonnet becomes the first line of the next sonnet, and on until the last line of the last sonnet brings you back to the very first line in that series of poems. And I kept thinking, what would happen if I took all the meat out, if I gutted the sonnet, if I got rid of all the lines in between the repeated lines? And I realized that if you were to do that, what you end up with is a huzzle. You sort of end up leaping. The huzzle is a form, it's one of our oldest forms. It's something like 5th century Persian, and it's couplets. And it's in stopped lines. And the two lines of the couplet most necessarily have nothing to do with each other.
Right.
And yet, because they are juxtaposed, begin to have everything to do with each other. And the same for the couplets in that form. The couplets in the huzzle are not discursive. They're not narrative. They're just sort of like one couplet after another. And you take them on accumulation. And the cumulative effect of them leads to an idea of poetry. There's also the signature at the end of of the hustle, which I've always been. Well, it's fascinating to me that there's literally a form on this earth that is so old, but there is a requirement that you say your name, that you sign it, mm-hmm. that you stand up in it, mm-hmm. that you say, this is mine. It's the most postmodern thing that's way before the postmodern. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
So I really love that mm-hmm. about the hustle. And the hustle's been very attractive to so many people of so many different aesthetics because of what it is as a form. And then after I started thinking about the sonnet and the hustle in this way, I was like, I wonder if I can create a form that sort of merges them. But what I was writing wasn't working. And part of the reason why is because I wasn't thinking in terms of tone. And what made the poems begin to work is giving them a certain kind of a blues aesthetic and understanding that between the first and the last line of the duplex, there would have to be a little bit of a lilt. There'd have to be a certain kind of talking that would go on in the poems. And I found that in between the first and the last line of the duplex, there are these absolute 100% blues stanzas. You know, there's a A prime B, A prime B because of the repeated lines, and that the repeated lines themselves turn into that line of variation in that B line. And so I wanted, it's so funny to talk about this on a radio show, right? This is totally poet nerd stuff, right?
No, this is what it's all about.
So what I ended up with is this form that was sharing in several forms. And I called it a duplex because I thought about what it means to share space. And I was really just thinking about a single body. What does it mean to have several subjectivities, several identities in a single body? But also, I was thinking about our nation. I was thinking about walls. I was thinking about that one wall that stands between two families in a duplex. Mm-hmm. What happens if that wall were to come down? How much do those families have to know about one another in order to live together in that single house that has somehow also become two houses? What does it mean to be one space with two addresses? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's how the couplets came about. That's how the repeated lines came about. And that's why the poem's called The Duplex. Yeah.
I love it, too, because the word duplex, like, that does come to mind for me, the idea of the piece mm-hmm. of real estate called mm-hmm. a duplex. Mm-hmm. But it also has it seems to have a more capacious meaning in it as well,
yeah.
duplex,
yeah.
you know, more than one,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Well, the plex, what I love about it is that the plex part of duplex sounds so futuristic. And there's something about it that's technological. There's something about it that's very contemporary. Mm-hmm. Do you know the sound of any word where we see the word plex? We think that something very contemporary is going on. And so I like the fact that the poems were, in a way, looking toward the future, mm-hmm. Even in their title, even in the name
their
of
sound.
The form.
Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's that X,
mm-hmm.
that futuristic X,
that
the
futurist,
flux capacitator.
Exactly. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So I like that. And I like the fact that it's sort of, you know, the duplex as a house, as a piece of real estate, inhabits sort of something we think of as a very old form. Right. But then that sound of plex, that sound of do sounds, those things seem to look forward. So I like that it's inhabiting both present, past, and future in some way.
I think also the duplex as a piece of real estate is, as you say, it's a sort of, I don't know that young people would, you know, I'm thinking about this development that just went up around where I live, mm-hmm. and there it's like high density urban living.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of connected mm-hmm. homes, but that you would never call that a duplex. It's mm-hmm. like it's something, there's also mm-hmm. a nod there to like mm-hmm. an older time or a mm-hmm. different mm-hmm. kind of place, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
I love that. I love it.
Well, since the book's come out, there have been a lot of people writing duplexes and posting them. There's one by a poet named Jay Dodd that's coming out, or maybe has already come out. in Bennington Review. So people are sending them around and getting them published. And
that's really amazing.
It's
How does
really
that
nice
feel?
To see people try their hand at the duplex in particular. It feels really great. It's really nice. It's really nice.
Are people using the signature?
There's no signature in the duplex in the same way right. that there's a signature in the Huzzle, but and yet the duplex is most assuredly a Huzzle.
Uh-huh.
But obviously, you know, all of these poems in this book are really formal, but you know, when I have a sonnet, I call it a sonnet subversion.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of subversiveness going on, and so you know, the Huzzle can be subverted as well.
Right.
So it's one way to sort of vary the form. I got really interested, to be quite honest. I was reading I've been reading for years now, this book by Robert Bly called The Night Abraham Calls Out to the Stars, mm-hmm. which is a bunch of Huzzles,
mm-hmm.
But they're not traditional Huzzles in the way that we were talking about them just now. It's another way that he was thinking about Huzzleship.
Mm-hmm.
Adrienne Rich's Shooting Script is actually a Huzzle, or she thinks of it that way. Yeah. And that's part of the reason why when I was a kid and I was first reading that poem, I couldn't understand it for the life of me.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so different in her oeuvre. Like, it's very different from other Adrienne Rich poems because she's trying to think about juxtaposition in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
So a very old way, but new for her.
That form is so unique because of those end-stopped lines.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
There's something there at the end of those lines mm-hmm. that... You know, that particular constraint
mm-hmm.
is so useful mm-hmm. and fruitful. It seems mm-hmm. like a fruitful thing, especially
yeah.
because it's intended to resist mm-hmm. narrative.
Yeah. Yeah.
And typically, you know, sentences lead up
yeah.
to, they make a story yeah. sentence after sentence. And so
yeah.
you're sort of both resisting something and, you know,
yeah.
making something else at the
it's
same time.
It's also, interestingly enough, a visual form. I mean, mm-hmm. when Aga Shahid Ali would talk about the Huzzle, he would say, you write a line and then you write another line that is about the same length as that line before. So it's literally looking on the page. It's not metrical. It's not syllabic even. It's literally, that's how long this line is. That's how long the next line should be by my eye.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
That's
Which
great.
Is really interesting.
Yeah.
To think about.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, as a poet, don't you so often like, I didn't know, you know, you're working on a poem and it's like, well, that line is too long.
Yeah.
It needs to, we do that,
yeah.
right? Visually
yeah.
as
yeah.
we're working on something
yeah. mm-hmm.
too. So
yeah.
it's.
I was thinking about this a lot. Actually, I did this when I was working on the duplex and when I was writing a few of the other formal poems in the book, the sonnets in particular, I decided that I needed help that I hadn't had in a little while because, you know, when you get out of school, you don't have the same kind of help you used to have because you have so much going on when you're an MFA or in a PhD program.
Mm-hmm.
You got your teachers, you got your classmates, and you're sort of reading intensely on assignment
yeah.
in a different way. So you're being helped in all these ways. And I realized I was doing all this formal work, but I had been away from that kind of immersion. And so I went to Sewanee to study with Mark Jarman and A.E. Stallings. And while I was there, I had this conversation with A.E. Stallings about lines, and you know, she's a formalist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dedicated, committed formalist. And she was saying she didn't understand why in the free verse poem the lines keep being the same length by the eye.
Mm-hmm.
She just couldn't get her mind
yeah.
around it. And I, you know, and that was something I was talking to her about Aga Shahid Ali and about form on the page, right? Is it possible to have a form that just really has to do with the way things look as opposed to a metrical sound or syllabics? So that's one of the things that I was thinking about, but it's also the reason why I have poems in the book where the lines are very varied.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was really the inspiration for me to rethink what I was doing with free verse in that way. So that's why Hero and Four Day in the Morning have long lines and short lines. A poem like The Microscopes, I think, has a varied line,
mm-hmm.
for instance. Yeah.
Was it a challenge to sort of let your lines be whatever length they, I mean, it's a different way of approaching
yeah.
it.
It was something I actually felt like I was going back to.
Mm.
When I first started writing poetry and I was writing this, the free verse line that I was writing, I just sort of wrote the line based on meaning rather than based on sight. So a line, one line would be long, one would be short. I mean, but in a very immature way. And so it was, this was a way for me to take what I had learned through craft and through study and to look at what I did in my natural self, in my immature poet self, and to give it some sort of a basis, you know? So I'm really proud of those poems, though. I'm really glad that I've been thinking about lines in different ways and that the different thinking about lines can appear in the same book has meaning for me. I think often when I read a book of poetry, I can see the project coming through a little too much. And I like the fact that various projects come together in a single book, in this book that I've made. And yet it has thematic concerns in common from beginning to end. So, you know, the book is still very new. It came out April 2nd. So how old does that make it? 13 days old or something? You know, I'm still enamored of her. I should probably be over her by now, but I can't. I
just 13 think, days.
Yeah, she's beautiful.
She's so beautiful.
She just has the best book cover
ever
and the best design. Even the back of the, I'm looking at the back of the book right now. Even the back of the book is gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
You know, I always tell people they should buy it just so that they can hold on to it, even if even if you don't like the poems. You know, it's just good to look at.
Yes.
But I worked really hard on these poems. They wore me out. And it's the work that I'm proudest of. I loved writing this book. You know, there's a different feeling. You know, you have sort of a feeling of love, of passion when you're working on a poem. You know, you go after it the way you might go after a lover. You know, when you really want to talk to somebody and you're calling them. You know, and that's the way I felt poem after poem writing this book. But I was also really, while it was very exhilarating to write this book, it was also quite exhausting. Because it seemed that the poems were coming after me. I could not stop writing. I wrote most of this book in a matter of 2 months.
Is that right?
I wrote it between Thanksgiving of 2017 and Martin Luther King Day of 2018.
Is that...
poems, you know, I revised them after that for about 6 months. But the first drafts, the beginning, they were, it would not... And it was the worst time. I was so busy with work. There were so many things going on. And these poems would not stop. They would not stop coming to me. I could not stop them. I was up, I would get up to use the, I was writing 2 and 3 poems a day.
Wow.
I was getting lines out of nowhere. I was pulling my car over to jot lines down. I would get up in the night. You know, you get up in the night to use the restroom. And I would be like, holding myself, trying to like not go to the restroom because suddenly I had an idea and I wanted to get it down. So there were many, there was a lot going on. I don't know what happened or why, but I was very grateful.
That's not typical.
No. Usually things are sort of eking out. You know that sound that you hear when the faucet is dripping and it's just enough to get on your nerves, drip, 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 you know? That's sort of how my poems go. Usually I'm just sort of slowly working, yeah. When I get to the end of something, you know, once I'm at about, I would say, 40 pages, then things get better because I can sort of see what I've been doing. But on the way, it's very slow. I'm always working every day. And yet having what I think of as a complete poem, I don't always have those. So when I went into this, I was probably, I had probably about 20 pages of poetry by the middle of January or late January. I had written on top of that 20 pages, I had written something like 50 pages of poetry.
Wow.
In, yeah, like in a month and a half, like 2 months.
God.
It was crazy.
Yeah, that is.
But it was beautiful. And so I always, when I'm looking at the tradition now, the literal physical manifestation of the book, that's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about that time in my life when I was overtaken by poetry.
Wow.
And I'm probably talking a lot, but I have to say this. I always think, I mean, to be quite honest with you, Carrie, I really do think this is my first book. I've never written a book for no reason. You know, this is the first book I ever wrote that wasn't a thesis or a dissertation or or to be on the market for a job in academia or to get tenure. It's just a book I wrote because I'm a poet. You know, these were poems I was working on because I was a poet. I wasn't going to get a raise. I wasn't going to get tenure. I didn't have to keep the lights on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I wonder if that has something to do with that experience that you were just talking about, the poems coming to you.
I think it was. I think, you know, I've always been one to write most when I need to escape from whatever else is happening. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot going on, so in a way it created an escape. But I also think I really did have it was the very first time that I experienced or came close to experiencing being a poet who wasn't under basic life need duress. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, I wasn't writing necessarily to pay the bills or to eat or to keep mm-hmm. the lights on in the same way that I had before. I was writing out of a sense of freedom. And having that sense of freedom, I think, allowed me to write under a different kind of pressure. And the pressure that is made, the urgency of this book, I think, is the pressure from the world, the cultural, the social landscape that we're literally living in right now. And I think that would not have happened to me. I wouldn't have been able to allow the world as it is to come through me into these poems if I was thinking about trying to make a beautiful poem. Mm-hmm. So that I could get tenure. Mm-hmm. Do you understand what
Absolutely.
I'm saying?
Absolutely. And in some ways, that's like the purest definition of what it means to be a poet, right?
Yeah.
That's like
yeah.
your real job.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like all those other things mm-hmm. are taken care of, and now you turn yeah. your yeah. self to the world yeah. and let it come to you.
Yeah. So in the poem, for instance, that you asked me to read, the duplex poem, I hadn't, you know, if you read my first two books, there are sort of hints about a rape. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the first book where I much more directly talked about that event in my life. And I think I was able to do that because of so much going on with the Me Too movement and me having to answer to it. I wasn't conscious of this writing the poems, but I could sort of look at the world and what was happening and see how my own life was reflective of what was going on in the world. I could think differently about, of course, I've known my entire life that Black people are treated in horrendous ways by the police. But then I suddenly could see my own personal fears line up with what I knew to be this common fear, mm-hmm. right? I could see past events of my life in a new light. And I had language for them. And the language, it wasn't just the event or the events. The language is what was coming first. And that's when I knew I was in poetry land. You know, you have mm-hmm. a poem. When there you are writing about something, but your need to write isn't because of what it's about. It's because of what you hear and what you feel in the language, and the language becomes material. Mm-hmm. You want to touch it. You mm-hmm. want to feel it on your tongue. Mm-hmm. Do you know? You want to yeah. say it out loud. You want to know what it's like when what your fingers feel like typing it, or what your hand feels like writing it. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's how I knew I had some work on my hands. So.
But when you were approaching this book, or when this... I should say maybe when this book was approaching you
mm-hmm.
and these poems were coming to you. I mean, you know, I've been reading your poems for a long time. And this book is, I wanted to talk a little bit about the way your poems resist resolution.
Mm-hmm.
But first, I just wanted to hear you speak maybe a little bit about how it felt to you as a person to be finally kind of addressing this personal experience. And were you hesitant? I mean, you know, was there any point where the book was done and you thought, oh God, I just, you know, this is a really hard thing to share?
Yeah. I mean, I still feel that
yeah.
way. I had mentioned to you before we started recording, when you said you wanted me to read this particular poem, I remember I was thinking, well, good, I have a reason to read it. Because when I'm just putting the set list for a reading together myself, I don't put it on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this book has a poem in it called Good White People. Mm-hmm. Do you, like, I'm not anxious to go around publicly reading Good White People. I mean, I stand by the poem, but there is a way that I know that people will hear these poems and think of them as controversial, if not the poems themselves, the topics of the poems as being sort of controversial. And I'm really not interested in making or servicing controversy. That's not what I came here for. What people see often as controversial is actually my everyday life. Mm. You know, what people think of as political is actually how some people get into and out of the grocery store every day. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, these things are real. These things that we want to give lip service to are real life. And many of the things that we're calling controversial have become so commonplace that it's really unfair for us. You know, I'm really sick of, I'm sick of people's surprise. Do you know what I mean? Every day, something happens in the American political landscape by which people say they just can't believe it. I'm like, why can't you believe it? It has happened the last 300 days, let alone the last 150 years. So how dare you say you cannot believe it? So I don't, you know, people kill me. They're like, oh, he's so controversial. I'm like, my poems are offensive? Like, what porn are you watching?
Right.
I mean, think about the movies people go see, but my poems,
right. Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Are somehow offensive to you? So, you know, there's a way that my work has been quite subtle in the past, and maybe in this book it's not as subtle. You were asking me about resolutions, and I think the lack of resolution at the end of many of these poems has to do with a turn toward sort of reaching back for some of that subtlety in the midst of the direct nature of these particular poems. But I think it also, I think that lack of resolution also has a lot to do with some present day pessimism that I'm feeling. I've always been an optimist. I've always been sort of a democratic pragmatist, and I'm much less so one these days, because I'm sort of looking at the truth and the reality of things in a different light. And I appreciate, you know, whenever you finish a book, you see whatever it is you've been writing about differently. And so I have to be honest with myself about how I feel about things. And I'm not as optimistic as I once was as a person. And I don't like saying that I am pessimistic. I don't like saying that, but I do feel much more an adult. And I wish more of my fellow citizens could be much more adult.
I think that is one of the ways that I perceive that throughout the book, and I don't find it to be new about your work mm-hmm. in this book. I think this is something that I'm drawn to in your work across your books. Mm-hmm. But that sense that, especially maybe in these times when things are so complicated and complex, and yet, you know, on the internet or in certain forums, like we think maybe some people may think, I'm going to go to poetry and it's going to enlighten or resolve this feeling of tension inside me. Be it political or personal, that it's going to show me the way, right? That's like what's one of the things that's on the shoulders of mm-hmm. poets. Mm-hmm. And that these poems, again and again, resist that sort of resolution at the end where, mm-hmm. you know, you're handed mm-hmm. An answer, mm-hmm. right? Or mm-hmm. this is the way you... And even the poem that ends with the names... Mm-hmm. The flowers,
the tradition, the title.
That's the title poem. Yeah, that's the other poem I was mm-hmm. wondering about asking you to read because it's just such a powerful poem. But I was thinking about that. I read it a million times, and I was thinking, you know, if this poem was like, you know, the way that we learn about narrative structure, you know, there's like the rising action, the climax, and the denouement. This poem like starts with the denouement, and then
it's true.
It's like
it's true, isn't it?
As soon as you get to the sort of moment of, you leave the poem so much less resolved as you enter the poem. And I just think that it's such a powerful poem. Like, it's emotionally powerful, but it's also just really genius.
Thank you.
I don't know if you could talk about that. Is that something that I'm curious to know, when you're revising, do you feel a sort of like, oh, you know, I need to resolve and to resist that, or is it just your sort of natural?
Well, you know, I think what we're always doing is we're trying to figure out what poetry is, and whatever we're saying it is at that moment is what we're trying to prove in our poems. We're trying to figure out what art is and what it is not. And when I was writing this book, I had the good fortune of writing it under the influence of a film titled Moonlight. I think I saw Moonlight the first time, and after that, I went to go see it again the next day because I had to have it. And watching it, I think I saw Moonlight 17 times in its first 2 weeks of being out in the world, because I literally was in different cities, going to conferences, giving readings, or at home. And I was like, I need to go understand. And, you know, I had no way of actually getting a hold of the film and like playing it, you know, in my living room or anything, or at least I didn't know how to make that happen. So I would just go and pay the money and watch Moonlight again and sit in the theater and cry. The first time I saw Moonlight, I really didn't see it because I just cried the whole time. And I realized that what I was feeling when I was watching the movie, and the reason I was going back to see the film over and over again, is because it was making me active. It was activating my brain. It was stimulating me in some way. It was stimulating my emotions. And I had to participate in the film. You know, the difference between, you know, maybe the difference between a Barry Jenkins film, Moonlight, and a Tyler Perry film, Madea Goes to Wherever Madea Goes to, right, is that Tyler Perry isn't going to ask us to interact with his films. The films are going to happen and we laugh, and that's pretty much what we're asked to do, and that's sort of a fine asking, you know, but I think the reason why Moonlight is set apart, the reason why Moonlight is definitely high art, is because every time we see it, we're asked, some other facet of our inner selves is called upon. And we're asked to do something. We're asked to participate. We're asked to ask questions. We're asked to see what the words have to do with the silences, have to do with the scenic backdrop, all at the same time. And
from the beginning to the end of that movie.
Yes. That's you.
It's not like, you know, oh, we're then at the end we're asked to sort of, it's just throughout. That's such a brilliant way of explaining.
From the time that we're in that car, in the opening, all the way to that embrace and that moment of cuddle. I mean, that's a moment of cuddle, right? At the end of that film, we have to be awake and we have to pay attention. If you're going to watch it, you really have to pay attention. I mean, to each and every subtle move every actor makes. But none of that gets resolved in that movie. We don't know where those characters are going. You know, we have some idea of where they're coming from. And that's our real lives. That's what it is to be human in this world, you know. I mean, it's a movie about surviving and about the wish to thrive, but to actually be in the midst of survival as opposed to being in the midst of thriving. Do you know what I mean? And I wanted my poems to reflect that sense much more definitely. There's a way I know that I had been getting at that in my first two books, but in this, my third book, in the tradition, in the poems that came after I was writing, after I had seen Moonlight, when I was writing, when I was revising, I was thinking about this in terms of resolution. I was thinking, how do I become an active reader in my, how am I not only the writer, but also the reader who is active in the poems, who is participating, who is, the poems are asking something of you, right? And I've always told, I've said this my entire career, I've always told people, if you want something from a poem, you're gonna get it. You gotta go looking for it and you will get it. If you want something from poetry, poetry has it there for you. You know, often people are reading poetry and they're sort of, particularly with contemporary poetry, dumbfounded and often disappointed in the ways that the poets of our time do not point to a resolution, do not point to an epiphany, do not point to advice or silver lining. Do you know what I mean? And the reason why I think we don't, the reason why I don't point to silver lining is because if that's what you want, you're welcome to get it. And if you want to find it, you're going to find it in my poem. But you have to participate. You've got to look for it, right? And poems, people are really upset often about poetry, I think. But that's because they want something from poetry that is greater than what they experience from any other art. And I think that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love that we have high expectations of poetry. Mm-hmm. But I also wish that we understood our expectations a little bit better. You know, we're listening to music on the radio. If you turn on the radio and you listen to music, your favorite station that plays your favorite genre of music, you don't hear every song. You don't really pay attention. You're driving in your car, you're washing your dishes, you're doing whatever you're doing and the radio's on. And every once in a while, literally every once in a while, a song comes on and you're in it. You love it. You're dancing in your seat while you're driving, right? Mm-hmm. But you've been listening to 30, 40, an hour of radio. What about all those songs? Why were they only in the background? Now, after that happens, after you have that experience of hearing one song you love out of several songs that were okay, you don't think, oh, I hate music. But people say that about poetry. People think that they hate poetry because they only like three poems. But how many poems do you want? It looks like three poems are sustaining you. Do you understand what I mean? We walk around, we're on a college campus right now, there's art on this campus. Mm-hmm. We walk around and we see art all day, every day in the world. We don't notice it, we walk around. Every once in a while we pass a painting and we're like, whoa. We pass a sculpture and like, what's that? That is what the experience of art is. It's about the same as the experience of falling in love. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen to you every day. You don't expect for it to happen to you every day. It is unique. Mm-hmm. It is tailored to you. Mm-hmm. Do you understand what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of thing that I was thinking about writing and revising these poems. I was thinking about what is tailored to the me that is a reader as well as the me that is a writer.
And then you wrote that book.
And then I wrote that book. I was trying to write the book I wanted to see in the world.
Isn't that the greatest advice?
Yeah.
For a writer.
Yeah. I mean, that's all we can do. I mean, as much as
writers
write
the poems that you want to read.
Yeah.
Write the poems that you need to
read. Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. That's all we can do. We have to do that, and we have to do it at its ultimate, at its height. Mm-hmm. We have to always be seeking. You know, that's what we're doing when we're reading. I mean, I love poetry. I mean, I like to write, but I like to read too. Mm-hmm. And in all of my reading, though I'm satisfied in many ways, there's always some piece of dissatisfaction, and that piece of discontent is where I feel in. It's where I go to work. I'm making that poem that's in the middle. I'm
as
making that poem I haven't gotten to when I'm reading.
As a reader?
Yeah, as a reader. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
That's something that's so hard. It only comes with experience. It's so hard to teach that skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To students, especially young students. Who, and then that translates. That's why you have to learn to write poetry by reading poetry. Yeah. You have to learn that, how to do that.
Exactly.
From a reader's point of view, before you can do it as a writer.
Exactly. Students are also in the position where they think they're supposed to already know what they have to say. Mm. And I think for me, there are two really hard things when it comes to teaching that I found. The hardest thing in the world, there are these two things. Thing number one is telling students not to know what they're doing. Trying to teach young people to learn by following the sounds of language, by following what comes next because something in your mind tells you that comes next, as opposed to having an answer, writing toward some idea that they already know, or writing some story they already know all of the facets of, mm-hmm. right? Teaching students what it quite literally means to discover
something.
Yeah. To be surprised. In order to be surprised, you have to write until you say something you didn't expect
you
to say.
You didn't know.
So if you know everything going into the poem, then you're not going to have a poem. You have to be searching. You have to be looking for it. And the act of writing, through the act of writing, you find that thing. So that's the first thing that's hard to teach. And the reason it's hard to teach is because of the second thing. And that's because nobody wants to fail at anything right. anymore. Do you know what I mean? And when people ask me what I teach or how I teach poetry, what I tell them is, you know, what I do is I teach young people to fail and to do damn good at failing. That failing is how we actually achieve everything that we've ever achieved. Right. Every one of my students drives a car. And I ask them, tell me about the first time you tried to drive a car. And the stories are horrific. Mm-hmm. Many of my students are really great cooks. And I ask them, I say, what's your favorite dish? I always say to my students, what is it that you can cook that's going to make me want to get you a ring? You know, and they'll tell me what they make, you know? And when they tell me what they make, I say, okay, now tell me about the first time you made it. And the stories are hilarious and horrific. And then I say to them, but you didn't stop.
Right.
You failed many times. Mm. Right? Mm. You embarrassed yourself many times before you were able to drive, before you were able to cook that dish. My students come to poetry and they want to be what Whitney Houston was to music right. when she was singing I Will Always Love You.
Right.
It's just like, no, you got to get there.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that I do is I love to play early Beyonce when she was singing with Destiny's Child. And Beyonce.
I'm familiar with that.
And Beyonce from the album 4. You know, it's very different singing. Somebody has really learned to sing.
Sorry about that.
Y'all are hilarious.
Okay. Do you really want me to tell Jericho Brown that?
What is...
She said that... Well, I'm going to. She said, I really liked to watch Kim Kardashian when she was on The Simple Life. She was on that Paris Hilton show?
Yeah.
Other best friend?
Yeah.
Is
she
that
was
right?
Like the servant to the best friends, right? And then she figured it out. I mean, part of what Rebecca is talking about is you figure it out. You apprentice yourself to something.
You understand who you
even
are.
Even the shallow.
Beyonce came to understand that she was Beyonce.
Yep. And she built it.
Yeah.
She made a decision that she was going to build something, that she was going to learn, that she was going to figure it out as she goes, which is how you write poetry. But you've got to be willing to fail.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be willing to fall flat on your face. And you have to know that it's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know that you could fail. And you just got to enjoy that. How do you have a good time enjoying that?
Yeah.
One way you have a good time enjoying that is play. You know, when kids play, they play.
Mm-hmm.
And when the game gets hard, they just change the doggone game.
Yeah.
They make
forward.
The games up as they go.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm trying to teach when I'm teaching poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to do when I'm doing poetry. It's also why I'm in no rush to publish a book. I've never been in any rush to see a poem in a magazine. Mm-hmm. You know, I take my time. I take my time because I like writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, publishing poems, seeing poems in print, you know, that's a lot of fun too. But what I'm really here for is to write the poems.
And that's another thing.
Joy.
that younger people, I don't know if it's like this day and age, but that sort of like the goal of writing is to be published, you know, even at my children's like elementary school. And I'm just like, I love it because it's great. But they have like a literary magazine or like an arts magazine, which is great. And I love it because you get to read and you get to see these minds at work. But at the same time, you know, my daughter doesn't need to be thinking about getting published, you know?
Yeah.
Her poems are like gold.
Yeah.
Because they come from a pure place and they have no intention.
Yep. Exactly.
Beyond their own coming to fruition in that moment.
Exactly. And they are utterance. Where it's like, oh, it's utterance.
Pure utterance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what we have to trick our minds into getting back to when we're writing. We want to get back to that point of utterance. I'm just writing because I'm writing. Things are going to get said, and that's okay. Do you know what I mean?
And even in a more practical sense, like aside from the art of writing, one thing that I tell students over and over again is that in the world of having a writing career and going forward in any career where you want stuff in the world, you have to get good at failing and being rejected. Like, you have to get good at it. You don't have to love it. That's like, it's not sadomasochism.
Yeah, no.
It's just like being able to go, damn, I freaking wanted that and I didn't get it. And that asshole got it.
You're right, though. You're right. Yeah,
and then just going like, okay.
This, and let that go.
Because if you can't do that, you will stop. It will stop you. I've seen, I mean, I'm sure you know writers who have been stopped to have the other thing and then don't have that, you know? And it's not something that you, it's a skill like anything else, you know?
Well, you know, it's really interesting when you think about sports. I think the reason why, or singing, or, you know, the music industry, for instance, I think the reason why Serena Williams or LeBron James or back to Beyonce, the reason why they're able to do the work that they do at the height of what they do it is because they are very disciplined people who are practicing all the time.
All the time.
And, you know, I tell my students, I don't, you know, I've never slept with Beyonce, but I know what she does in the morning when she gets in the shower. She does scales because that's what you do when you're a singer. Do re mi so fa la ti do.
You start at the beginning.
Yeah. And you do scales and you clear your voice out. And anytime somebody's like holding notes while turning flips on stage, they're also just doing scales on a daily basis in the morning. Do you know what I mean?
And you can't do the other without starting there. Yeah. And even when you're doing the other, you're starting
there. And a
lot
of people are having barbershop conversations about basketball, but you do not want to have a conversation with LeBron James about basketball. Because he's going to wear you out. He knows basketball. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so that's sort of what, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about discipline. We're talking about what we imagine our supposed idols doing with their time. You know, I think we like to imagine that our supposed islands are, our supposed idols are just all around, like, I guess, like, they're all like laid up in Cancun drinking like pineapple vodka or something. I don't know. Do you understand what I mean? But that's not their lives.
No. They we've seen so many. I mean, like, there are so many stories of, you know, the there's in that industry, in the music industry or the, you know, the celebrity culture, you see people just succumb to that. That sort of, I just lost my way and the excess was so accessible to me that I, you know, we've lost a lot of amazing talents that way. You know, even before they've like been lost, like their lives were lost, you know. So I always like to ask guests to bring in a poem because there's nothing better and more pleasing to me than to hear a poet talk about their favorite poem or a poem that has meant a lot to them. So what did you, I do not see a book in front of you, which is awesome because it means it's in your heart.
Yeah, I know this poem by heart. It's a poem by Lucille Clifton, and it was first published in a book called Next. And I love that book, and I love this poem. It's an untitled poem, as many Lucille Clifton poems are. But it's the poem, when we talk about the poem, it's referred to as cruelty because that's the first word in the poem. It's cruelty, period, is how the poem begins. And interestingly enough, I'll say this, though. no one hearing it can necessarily see it, though if they look it up, they will see it. It's a poem of couplets, and it's really long lines for Clifton, long mm-hmm. lines for Clifton, which I think is part of what makes it very special to me. I remember turning the page the first time I encountered it and seeing it and thinking, what is this gonna be? Because it doesn't look like any other Lucille Clifton poem. Not then and not since then. It's really set apart formally. Hmm. Here it is. Let's see. Cruelty. Don't talk to me about cruelty or what I am capable of. When I wanted the roaches dead, I wanted them dead, and I killed them. I took a broom to their country and smashed and sliced without warning, without stopping, and I smiled all the time I was doing it. It was a holocaust of roaches, bodies, parts of bodies, red all over the ground. I didn't ask their names. They had no names worth knowing. Now I watch myself whenever I enter a room. I never know what I might do. Isn't that crazy? It's crazy. That's poetry right there, right?
Because I've never heard that poem before.
It's beautiful, right? And it's crazy. It's funny. Mm-hmm. It's like got these. It's got so many tones in it. Cruelty. Don't talk to me about cruelty or what I am capable of. You know, look at how that starts. Mm-hmm. It also invites a reader. Don't talk to me. Who are you talking to? There's somebody
it's
out
in the
there.
Middle of a. It's in the middle yeah. of a conversation.
I mean, so she's the poem is starting cruelty subject. Cruelty. Don't talk to me about cruelty or what I am capable of. Mm-hmm. Don't talk to me about this thing you were trying to talk to me about before this poem even started. Mm-hmm. And do not talk to me about what I'm capable of. Mm-hmm. Right, so we're already in we're in the danger zone in the first line of this poem. And then it's total subversion of the danger zone. Right. When I wanted the roaches dead, I wanted them dead and I killed them. Look at that repetition. When I wanted the roaches dead, I wanted them dead. This is so amazing. So it's mythical. Mm-hmm. Right. We just turn like something as small as the roach in the same. That's the same line. When I wanted the roaches, they're roaches. You know, I think we've seen them. This is Texas. Mm-hmm. Right. When I wanted the roaches dead, I wanted them dead and I killed them. Suddenly the zoom effect of that. Mm-hmm. Right. And I killed them. I took a broom. Mm-hmm. Watch this. Same line. I took a broom. Y'all see a broom? To their country. Mm-hmm. Right? So again, the scale is changing. The tones are changing. And smashed and sliced without warning, without stopping. And I smiled all the time I was doing it. All that murder. Right? And then, so now we're in the land of like sort of teeter-tottering on the land of the humorous and the very serious. Mm-hmm. And I smiled all the time I was doing it. And then this is risk right here. It was a holocaust of roaches. That is either completely offensive or entirely funny.
Right.
Lucille Clifton was not playing with y'all. Mm-mm. Do you know what I'm saying? It was a holocaust of roaches. Mm-hmm. Bodies, parts of bodies, red all over the ground. Roaches do not give you blood. When you kill roaches, there's not red all right. over the ground.
It's their bodies.
Eggs. They give you eggs. That's what that is. That's eggs. You're absolutely right. Right? You see what I mean? Red all over the ground. I didn't ask their names. Notice now the roaches have become fully human. Mm-hmm. And this poem that was at one level domestic and at another level mythic suddenly becomes very human, mm-hmm. very interested in how she began the poem, what I am capable of. I too can commit these atrocities. I didn't ask their names. They had no names worth knowing. Now I watch myself whenever I enter a room. So you want to talk about epiphany. Resolution.
It reminds me of the tradition, yeah. the poem, the tradition.
So the poem seems to not know.
It ends yeah. on its most unresolved
exactly.
note.
Exactly. Very good. Yes. Yes.
I mean, it's like a cliche, but really it is the kind of ending that the phrase mic drop mm-hmm. was meant to indicate, yeah,
exactly.
you know?
Exactly. And in a way, I always think that the poem is a bit of an ars poetica too. Right,
like it's also like somebody, it's like almost like in response to me, I hear it almost as a response to someone going, oh, Lucille, you're so, when my spirit is low, I come and I read your poems because right? you were so right, wise right. and so good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, there's like, not an ounce of cruelty in your poems.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's where the poem begins. Yeah, exactly. Cruelty. Don't talk to me about
Don't
cruelty.
Don't talk to me about cruelty. Yep.
You've mm-hmm. made me into this thing, and yeah. this is what I am capable
and
of.
She is, I never know what I might do, mm. is the end of that poem.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. It's a very honest poem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's good, man. She's good. She's good.
I don't understand why. I mean, because like I'm in the sheltered world of poetry and all poets love and admire Lucille Clifton. Mm-hmm. But her voice just needs to be, she's like Dickinson, mm-hmm. you know? She needs to be like a household name.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I think that's going to, I mean, in a way that's happened among poets and artists already, but I think that's going to ultimately be the Lucille Clifton poem mm-hmm. story. The Lucille Clifton story will be that she's much more a household name.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I daily will be trying to make that happen.
Thank you.
You can find Jericho Brown's poem Duplex in his new book, The Tradition, out now from Copper Canyon Press. This Is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.